In order to sharpen the distinction between transcendentalism and empiricism, I have constructed a debate between defenders of the two world views. To add passionate conviction, I have also made the transcendentalist a theist and the empiricist a skeptic. And to be as fair as possible, I have drawn their arguments from the most closely reasoned sources in theology and philosophy of which I am aware. The Transcendentalist. Before taking up ethics, let me affirm the logic of theism, because if the existence of a law-giving God is conceded, the origin of ethics is instantly settled. So please consider carefully the following argument in favor of theism. I challenge your rejection of theism on your own empiricist grounds. How can you ever hope to disprove the existence of a personal God? How can you explain away the 3,000 years of spiritual testimony from the followers of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam? Hundreds of millions of people, including a large percentage of the educated citizens of industrialized countries, know there is an unseen, sentient power guiding their lives. The testimony is overwhelming. According to recent polls, 9 in 10 Americans believe in a personal God who can answer prayers and perform miracles. 1 in 5 has experienced his presence and guidance at least once during the year previous to the poll. How can science, the underwriting discipline of ethical empiricism, dismiss such widespread testimony? The nucleus of the scientific method, we are constantly reminded, is the rejection of certain propositions in favor of others in strict conformity to fact-based logic. Where are the facts that require the rejection of a personal God? It isn't enough to say that the idea is unnecessary to explain the physical world, at least as scientists understand it. Too much is at stake for theism to be dismissed with that flip of the hand. The burden of proof is on you, not on those who believe in a divine presence. Looked at in proper perspective, God subsumes science. Science does not subsume God. Scientists collect data on certain subjects and build hypotheses to explain them. In order to extend the reach of objective knowledge as far as they can, they provisionally accept some hypotheses while discarding others. That knowledge, however, can cover only part of reality. Scientific research in particular is not designed to explore all of the wondrous varieties of human mental experience. The idea of God, in contrast, has the capacity to explain everything, not just measurable phenomena, but phenomena personally felt and subliminally sensed, including revelations that can be communicated solely through spiritual channels. Why should all mental experience be visible in PET scans? Unlike science, the idea of God is concerned with more than the material world given us to explore. It opens our minds to what lies outside that world. It instructs us to reach out to the mysteries that are comprehensible through faith alone. Confine your thoughts to the material world if you wish. Others know that God encompasses the ultimate causes of the creation. Where do the laws of nature come from, if not a power higher than the laws themselves? Science offers no answer to that sovereign question of theology. Put another way, why is there something rather than nothing? The ultimate meaning of existence lies beyond the rational grasp of human beings, and therefore outside the province of science. Are you also a pragmatist? There is an urgently practical reason for belief in ethical precepts ordained by a supreme being. To deny such an origin, to assume that moral codes are exclusively man-made, is a dangerous creed. As Dostoevsky's Grand Inquisitor observed, all things are permitted when there is no ruling hand of God, and freedom turns to misery. In support of that caveat, we have nothing less than the authority of the original Enlightenment thinkers themselves. Virtually all believed in the God who created the universe, and many were devout Christians to boot. Almost none was willing to abandon ethics to secular materialism. John Locke said that those who deny the existence of the deity are not to be tolerated at all. Promises, covenants, and oaths, which are the bonds of human society, can have no hold upon or sanctity for an atheist, for the taking away of God, even only in thought, dissolves all. Robert Hooke, a great physicist of the 17th century, in composing a brief on the newly created Royal Society, wisely cautioned that the purpose of this quintessential Enlightenment organization should be to improve the knowledge of natural things and all useful arts, manufactures, mechanic practices, engines and inventions by experiments, not meddling with divinity, metaphysics, morals, politics, grammar, rhetoric, or logic. These sentiments are just as prevalent among leading thinkers of the modern era as well as a large minority of working scientists. They are reinforced by queasiness over the idea of organic evolution as espoused by Darwin. This keystone of empiricism presumes to reduce the creation to the products of random mutations and environmental circumstance. Even George Bernard Shaw, an avowed atheist, responded to Darwinism with despair. He condemned its fatalism and the demoting of beauty, intelligence, honor, and aspiration to an abstract notion of blindly assembled matter. Many writers have suggested, not unfairly in my opinion, that such a sterile view of life, which reduces human beings to little more than intelligent animals, gave intellectual justification to the genocidal horrors of Nazism and communism. So surely there is something wrong with the reigning theory of evolution. Even if some form of genetic change occurs within species in the manner proclaimed by the new Darwinism, the full, stupendous complexity of modern organisms could not have been created by blind chance alone. Time and again, in the history of science, new evidence has overturned prevailing theories. Why are scientists so anxious to stay with autonomous evolution and to discount the possibility of an intelligent design instead? It is all very curious. Design would seem to be a simpler explanation than the random self-assembly of millions of kinds of organisms. Finally, theism gains compelling force in the case of the human mind and, I won't shrink from saying it, the immortal soul. Little wonder that a quarter or more of Americans reject totally the idea of any kind of human evolution, even in anatomy and physiology. Science pushed too far is science arrogant. Let it keep its proper place as the God-given gift to understand His physical dominion. The Empiricist. I'll begin by freely acknowledging that religion has an overwhelming attraction for the human mind, and that religious conviction is largely beneficent. Religion rises from the innermost coils of the human spirit. It nourishes love, devotion, and above all, hope. People hunger for the assurance it offers. I can think of nothing more emotionally compelling than the Christian doctrine that God incarnated Himself in testimony of the sacredness of all human life, even of the slave, and that He died and rose again in promise of eternal life for everyone. But religious belief has another, destructive side, equaling the worst excesses of materialism. An estimated 100,000 belief systems have existed in history, and many have fostered ethnic and tribal wars. Each of the three great Western religions in particular expanded at one time or another in symbiosis with military aggression. Islam, which means submission, was imposed by force of arms on large portions of the Middle East, Mediterranean perimeter, and southern Asia. Christianity dominated the New World as much by colonial expansion as by spiritual grace. It benefited from a historical accident. Europe, having been blocked to the east by the Muslim Arabs, turned west to occupy the Americas, whereupon the cross accompanied the sword in one campaign of enslavement and genocide after another. The Christian rulers had an instructive example to follow in the early history of Judaism. If we are to believe the Old Testament, the Israelites were ordered by God to wipe the promised land clean of heathen. Of these people which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance, you shall let nothing that breathes remain alive, but you shall utterly destroy them, the Hittite and the Amorite, and the Canaanite, and the Perizzite, and the Hivite, and the Jebusite, as the Lord your God has commanded you. Thus reports Deuteronomy, chapter 20, verse 16 to 17. Over 100 cities were consumed by fire and death, beginning with Joshua's campaign against Jericho, and ending with David's assault on the ancient Jebusite stronghold of Jerusalem. I bring up these historical facts not to cast aspersions on present-day faiths, but rather to cast light on their material origins and those of the ethical systems they sponsor. All great civilizations were spread by conquest, and among their chief beneficiaries were the religions validating them. No doubt membership in state-sponsored religions has always been deeply satisfying in many psychological dimensions, and spiritual wisdom has evolved to moderate the more barbaric tenets obeyed in the days of conquest. But every major religion today is a winner in the Darwinian struggle waged among cultures, and none ever flourished by tolerating its rivals. The swiftest road to success has always been sponsorship by a conquering state. To be fair, let me now put the matter of cause and effect straight. Religious exclusion and bigotry arise from tribalism, the belief in the innate superiority and special status of the in-group. Tribalism cannot be blamed on religion. The same causal sequence gave rise to totalitarian ideologies. The pagan corpus mysticum of Nazism and the class warfare doctrine of Marxism-Leninism, both essentially dogmas of religions without God, were put to the service of tribalism, not the reverse. Neither would have been so fervently embraced if their devotees had not thought themselves chosen people, virtuous in their mission, surrounded by wicked enemies, and conquerors by right of blood and destiny. Mary Wollstonecraft correctly said of male domination, but extensible to all human behavior, "No man chooses evil because it is evil. He only mistakes it for happiness, which is the good he seeks." Conquest by a tribe requires that its members make sacrifices to the interests of the group, especially during conflict with competing groups. That is simply the expression of a primal rule of social life throughout the animal kingdom. It arises when loss of personal advantage by submission to the needs of the group is more than offset by gain in personal advantage due to the resulting success of the group. The human corollary is that selfish, prosperous people belonging to losing religions and ideologies are replaced by selfless, poor members of winning religions and ideologies. A better life later on, either an earthly paradise or resurrection in heaven, is the promised reward that cultures invent to justify the subordinating imperative of social existence. Repeated from one generation to the next, submission to the group and its moral codes is solidified in official doctrine and personal belief. But it is not ordained by God or plucked from the air as self-evident truth. It evolves as a necessary device of survival in social organisms. The most dangerous of devotions, in my opinion, is the one endemic to Christianity. I was not born to be of this world. With a second life waiting, suffering can be endured, especially in other people. The natural environment can be used up. Enemies of the faith can be savaged, and suicidal martyrdom praised. Is it all an illusion? Well, I hesitate to call it that, or worse, a noble lie, the harsh phrase sometimes used by skeptics, but one has to admit that the objective evidence supporting it is not strong. No statistical proofs exist that prayer reduces illness and mortality, except perhaps through a psychogenic enhancement of the immune system. If it were otherwise, the whole world would pray continuously. When two armies blessed by priests clash, one still loses, and when the martyr's righteous forebrain is exploded by the executioner's bullet and his mind disintegrates, what then? Can we safely assume that all those millions of neural circuits will be reconstituted in an immaterial state, so that the conscious mind carries on? The smart money in eschatology is on Blaise Pascal's wager: live well, but accept the faith. If there is an afterlife, the 17th century French philosopher reasoned, the believer has a ticket to paradise and the best of both worlds. If I lost, Pascal wrote, I would have lost little. If I won, I would have gained eternal life. Now think like an empiricist for a moment. Consider the wisdom of turning the wager around as follows. If fear and hope and reason dictate that you must accept the faith, do so, but treat this world as if there is none other. I know true believers will be scandalized by this line of argument. Their wrath falls on outspoken heretics who are considered at best troublemakers, and at worst, traitors to the social order. But no evidence has been adduced that non-believers are less law-abiding or productive citizens than believers of the same socioeconomic class, or that they face death less bravely. A 1996 survey of American scientists, to take one respectable segment of society, revealed that 46% are atheists and 14% doubters or agnostics. Only 36% expressed a desire for immortality, and most of those only moderately so. 64% claimed no desire at all. True character arises from a deeper well than religion. It is the internalization of the moral principles of a society augmented by those tenets personally chosen by the individual, strong enough to endure through trials of solitude and adversity. The principles are fitted together into what we call integrity, literally the integrated self, wherein personal decisions feel good and true. Character is, in turn, the enduring source of virtue. It stands by itself and excites admiration in others. It is not obedience to authority, and while it is often consistent with and reinforced by religious belief, it is not piety. Nor is science the enemy. It is the accumulation of humanity's organized objective knowledge, the first medium devised, able to unite people everywhere in common understanding. It favors no tribe or religion. It is the base of a truly democratic and global culture. You say that science cannot explain spiritual phenomena. Why not? The brain sciences are making important advances in the analysis of complex operations of the mind. There is no apparent reason why they cannot in time provide a material account of the emotions and ratiocination that compose spiritual thought. You ask, where ethical precepts come from, if not divine revelation? Consider the alternative empiricist hypothesis that precepts and religious faith are entirely material products of the mind. For more than 1,000 generations, they have increased the survival and reproductive success of those who conformed to tribal faiths. There was more than enough time for epigenetic rules, hereditary biases of mental development, to evolve that generate moral and religious sentiments. Indoctrinability became an instinct. Ethical codes are precepts reached by consensus under the guidance of the innate rules of mental development. Religion is the ensemble of mythic narratives that explain the origin of a people, their destiny, and why they are obliged to subscribe to particular rituals and moral codes. Ethical and religious beliefs are created from the bottom up, from people to their culture. They do not come from the top down, from God or other non-material source to the people by way of culture. Which hypothesis, transcendentalist or empiricist, fits the objective evidence best? The empiricist, by a wide margin. To the extent that this view is accepted, more emphasis in moral reasoning will be placed on social choice and less on religious and ideological authority. Such a shift has, in fact, been occurring in Western cultures since the Enlightenment, but the pace has been very slow. Part of the reason is a gross insufficiency of knowledge needed to judge the full consequences of our moral decisions, especially for the long term, say a decade or more. We have learned a great deal about ourselves and the world in which we live, but need a great deal more to be fully wise. There is a temptation at every great crisis to yield to transcendental authority, and perhaps that is better for a while. We are still indoctrinable. We still are easily God-struck. Resistance to empiricism is also due to a purely emotional shortcoming of the mode of reasoning it promotes. It is bloodless. People need more than reason. They need the poetry of affirmation. They crave an authority greater than themselves at rites of passage and other moments of high seriousness. A majority desperately wish for the immortality the rituals seem to underwrite. Great ceremonies summon the history of a people in solemn remembrance. They showcase the sacred symbols. That is the enduring value of ceremony, which in all high civilizations has historically assumed a mostly religious form. Sacred symbols infiltrate the very bones of culture. They will take centuries to replace, if ever. So I may surprise you by granting this much. It would be a sorry day if we abandoned our venerated sacral traditions. It would be a tragic misreading of history to expunge under God from the American Pledge of Allegiance. Whether atheists or true believers, let oaths be taken with hand on the Bible, and may we continue to hear, "So help me God." Call upon priests and ministers and rabbis to bless civil ceremony with prayer, and by all means, let us bow our heads in communal respect. Recognize that when introits and invocations prickle the skin, we are in the presence of poetry and the soul of the tribe, something that will outlive the particularities of sectarian belief and perhaps belief in God itself. But to share reverence is not to surrender the precious self and obscure the true nature of the human race. We should not forget who we are. Our strength is in truth and knowledge and character under whatever sign. Judeo-Christians are told by Holy Scripture that pride goeth before destruction. I disagree. It's the reverse. Destruction goeth before pride. Empiricism has turned everything around in the formula. It has destroyed the giddying theory that we are special beings placed by a deity in the center of the universe, in order to serve as the summit of creation for the glory of the gods. We can be proud as a species, because having discovered that we are alone, we owe the gods very little. Humility is better shown to our fellow humans and the rest of life on this planet, on whom all hope really depends. And if any gods are paying attention, surely we have earned their admiration by making that discovery and setting out alone to accomplish the best of which we are capable. The argument of the empiricist, to repeat my earlier confession, is my own. It is far from novel, having roots that go back to Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, and in the beginning of the modern era, to David Hume's A Treatise of Human Nature, 1739 to 1740. The first clear evolutionary elaboration of it was by Darwin in The Descent of Man, 1871. The argument of the religious transcendentalist, on the other hand, is the one I first learned as a child in the Christian faith. I have reflected on it repeatedly since, and am by intellect and temperament bound to respect its ancient traditions. It is also the case that religious transcendentalism is bolstered by secular transcendentalism, with which it has fundamental similarities. Immanuel Kant, judged by history, the greatest of secular philosophers, addressed moral reasoning very much as a theologian. Human beings, he argued, are independent moral agents with a holy free will capable of obeying or breaking moral law. There is in man a power of self-determination, independent of any coercion through sensuous impulses. Our minds are subject to a categorical imperative, he said, of what our actions ought to be. The imperative is a good in itself alone, apart from all other considerations, and it can be recognized by this rule. Act only on that maxim through which you wish also it become a universal law. Most important and transcendental, ought has no place in nature. Nature, Kant said, is a system of cause and effect, while moral choice is a matter of free will for which there is no cause and effect. In making moral choices, in rising above mere instinct, human beings transcend the realm of nature and enter a realm of freedom that belongs to them exclusively as rational creatures. Now this formulation has a comforting feel to it, but it makes no sense at all in terms of either material or imaginable entities, which is why Kant, even apart from his tortured prose, is so hard to understand. Sometimes a concept is baffling, not because it is profound, but because it is wrong. It does not accord, we know now, with the evidence of how the brain works. In Principia Ethica, 1903, G. E. Moore, the founder of modern ethical philosophy, essentially agreed with Kant. Moral reasoning, in his view, cannot dip into psychology and the social sciences in order to locate ethical principles, because they yield only a causal picture and fail to illuminate the basis of moral justification. So to pass from the factual is to the normative ought commits a basic error of logic, which Moore called the naturalistic fallacy. John Rawls, in A Theory of Justice, 1971, once again traveled the transcendental road. He offered the very plausible premise that justice be defined as fairness, which is to be accepted as an intrinsic good. It is the imperative we would follow if we had no starting information about our own status in life. But in making such an assumption, Rawls ventured no thought on where the human brain comes from or how it works. He offered no evidence that justice as fairness is consistent with human nature, hence practicable as a blanket premise. Probably it is, but how can we know, except by blind trial and error. I find it hard to believe that had Kant, Moore, and Rawls known modern biology and experimental psychology, they would have reasoned as they did. Yet, as this century closes, transcendentalism remains firm in the hearts not just of religious believers, but also of countless scholars in the social sciences and humanities who, like Moore and Rawls before them, have chosen to insulate their thinking from the natural sciences. Many philosophers will respond by saying, "But wait, what are you saying? Ethicists don't need that kind of information. You really can't pass from is to ought. You are not allowed to describe a genetic predisposition and suppose that because it is part of human nature, it is somehow transformed into an ethical precept. We must put moral reasoning in a special category and use transcendental guidelines as required." No. We do not have to put moral reasoning in a special category and use transcendental premises, because the posing of the naturalistic fallacy is itself a fallacy. For if ought is not is, what is? To translate is into ought makes sense if we attend to the objective meaning of ethical precepts. They are very unlikely to be ethereal messages outside humanity awaiting revelation, or independent truths vibrating in a non-material dimension of the mind. They are more likely to be physical products of the brain and culture. From the consilient perspective of the natural sciences, they are no more than principles of the social contract hardened into rules and dictates, the behavioral codes that members of a society fervently wish others to follow and are willing to accept themselves for the common good. Precepts are the extreme in a scale of agreements that range from casual assent to public sentiment to law to that part of the canon considered unalterable and sacred. The scale applied to adultery might read as follows. Let's not go further. It doesn't feel right, and it would lead to trouble. We probably ought not. Adultery not only causes feelings of guilt, it is generally disapproved of by society, so these are other reasons to avoid it. We ought not. Adultery isn't just disapproved of, it's against the law. We almost certainly ought not. God commands that we avoid this mortal sin. We absolutely ought not. In transcendental thinking, the chain of causation runs downward from the given ought in religion or natural law, through jurisprudence to education, and finally to individual choice. The argument from transcendentalism takes the following general form. There is a supreme principle, either divine or intrinsic in the order of nature, and we will be wise to learn about it and find the means to conform to it. Thus, John Rawls opens a theory of justice with a proposition he regards as irrevocable. In a just society, the liberties of equal citizenship are taken as settled. The rights secured by justice are not subject to political bargaining or to the calculus of social interests. As many critiques have made clear, that premise can lead to many unhappy consequences when applied to the real world, including the tightening of social control and decline of personal initiative. A very different premise, therefore, is suggested by Robert Nozick in Anarchy, State, and Utopia, 1974. Individuals have rights, and there are things no person or group may do to them without violating their rights. So strong and far-reaching are these rights that they raise the question of what, if anything, the state and its officials may do. Rawls would point us toward egalitarianism regulated by the state, Nozick toward libertarianism in a minimalist state. The empiricist view, in contrast, searching for an origin of ethical reasoning that can be objectively studied, reverses the chain of causation. the individual is seen as predisposed biologically to make certain choices. By cultural evolution, some of the choices are hardened into precepts, then laws, and if the predisposition or coercion is strong enough, a belief in the command of God or the natural order of the universe. The general empiricist principle takes this form. Strong innate feeling and historical experience cause certain actions to be preferred. We have experienced them and weighed their consequences and agree to conform with codes that express them. Let us take an oath upon the codes, invest our personal honor in them, and suffer punishment for their violation. The empiricist view concedes that moral codes are devised to conform to some drives of human nature and to suppress others. Ought is not the translation of human nature, but of the public will, which can be made increasingly wise and stable through the understanding of the needs and pitfalls of human nature. It recognizes that the strength of commitment can wane as a result of new knowledge and experience, with the result that certain rules may be desacralized, old laws rescinded, and behavior that was once prohibited freed. It also recognizes that for the same reason, new moral codes may need to be devised, with the potential in time of being made sacred. If the empiricist worldview is correct, ought is just shorthand for one kind of factual statement, a word that denotes what society first chose or was coerced to do and then codified. The naturalistic fallacy is thereby reduced to the naturalistic dilemma. The solution of the dilemma is not difficult. It is this: ought is the product of a material process. The solution points the way to an objective grasp of the origin of ethics. A few investigators are now embarked on just such a foundational inquiry. Most agree that ethical codes have arisen by evolution through the interplay of biology and culture. In a sense, they are reviving the idea of moral sentiments developed in the 18th century by the British empiricists Francis Hutcheson, David Hume, and Adam Smith. By moral sentiments is now meant moral instincts as defined by the modern behavioral sciences, subject to judgment according to their consequences. The sentiments are thus derived from epigenetic rules, hereditary biases in mental development, usually conditioned by emotion, that influence concepts and decisions made from them. The primary origin of the moral instincts is the dynamic relation between cooperation and defection. The essential ingredient for the molding of the instincts during genetic evolution in any species is intelligence high enough to judge and manipulate the tension generated by the dynamism. That level of intelligence allows the building of complex mental scenarios well into the future, as I described in the earlier chapter on the mind. It occurs, so far as known, only in human beings and perhaps their closest relatives among the higher apes. A way of envisioning the hypothetical earliest stages of moral evolution is provided by game theory, particularly the solutions to the famous prisoner's dilemma. Consider the following typical scenario of the dilemma. Two gang members have been arrested for murder and are being questioned separately. The evidence against them is strong but not compelling. The first gang member believes that if he turns state's witness, he will be granted immunity and his partner will be sentenced to life in prison. But he is also aware that his partner has the same option. That is the dilemma. Will the two gang members independently defect so that both take the hard fall? They will not, because they agreed in advance to remain silent if caught. By doing so, both hope to be convicted on a lesser charge or escape punishment altogether. Criminal gangs have turned this principle of calculation into an ethical precept. Never rat on another member. Always be a stand-up guy. Honor does exist among thieves. If we view the gang as a society of sorts, the code is the same as that of a captive soldier in wartime, obliged to give only name, rank, and serial number. In one form or another, comparable dilemmas that are solvable by cooperation occur constantly and everywhere in daily life. The payoff is variously money, status, power, sex, access, comfort, and health. Most of these proximate rewards are converted into the universal bottom line of Darwinian genetic fitness, greater longevity, and a secure, growing family. And so it has likely always been. Imagine a Paleolithic hunter band, say composed of 5 men. One hunter considers breaking away from the others to look for an antelope on his own. If successful, he will gain a large quantity of meat and hide, 5 times greater than if he stays with the band and they are successful. But he knows from experience that his chances of success alone are very low, much less than the chances of a band of 5 working together. In addition, whether successful alone or not, he will suffer animosity from the others for lessening their own prospects. By custom, the band members remain together and share the animals they kill equitably. So the hunter stays. He also observes good manners while doing so, especially if he is the one who makes the kill. Boastful pride is condemned because it rips the delicate web of reciprocity. Now suppose that human propensities to cooperate or defect are heritable. Some members are innately more cooperative, others less so. In this respect, moral aptitude would simply be like almost all other mental traits studied to date. Among traits with documented heritability, those closest to moral aptitude are empathy to the distress of others and certain processes of attachment between infants and their caregivers. To the heritability of moral aptitude, add the abundant evidence of history that cooperative individuals generally survive longer and leave more offspring. It is to be expected that in the course of evolutionary history, genes predisposing people toward cooperative behavior would have come to predominate in the human population as a whole. Such a process, repeated through thousands of generations, inevitably gave birth to the moral sentiments. With the exception of stone psychopaths, if any truly exist, these instincts are vividly experienced by every person variously as conscience, self-respect, remorse, empathy, shame, humility, and moral outrage. They bias cultural evolution toward the conventions that express the universal moral codes of honor, patriotism, altruism, justice, compassion, mercy, and redemption. The dark side to the inborn propensity to moral behavior is xenophobia. Because personal familiarity and common interest are vital in social transactions, moral sentiments evolved to be selective, and so it has ever been, and so it will ever be. People give trust to strangers with effort, and true compassion is a commodity in chronically short supply. Tribes cooperate only through carefully defined treaties and other conventions. They are quick to imagine themselves victims of conspiracies by competing groups, and they are prone to dehumanize and murder their rivals during periods of severe conflict. They cement their own group loyalties by means of sacred symbols and ceremonies. Their mythologies are filled with epic victories over menacing enemies. The complementary instincts of morality and tribalism are easily manipulated. Civilization has made them more so. Only 10,000 years ago, a tick in geological time, when the agricultural revolution began in the Middle East, in China, and in Mesoamerica, populations increased in density tenfold over those of hunter-gatherer societies. Families settled on small plots of land, villages proliferated, and labor was finally divided as a growing minority of the populace specialized as craftsmen, traders, and soldiers. The rising agricultural societies, egalitarian at first, became hierarchical. As chiefdoms and then states thrived on agricultural surpluses, hereditary rulers and priestly castes took power. The old ethical codes were transformed into coercive regulations, always to the advantage of the ruling classes. About this time, the idea of law-giving gods originated. Their commands lent the ethical codes overpowering authority, once again, no surprise, to the favor of the rulers. Because of the technical difficulty of analyzing such phenomena in an objective manner, and because people resist biological explanations of their higher cortical functions in the first place, very little progress has been made in the biological exploration of the moral sentiments. Even so, it is an astonishing circumstance that the study of ethics has advanced so little since the 19th century. As a result, the most distinguishing and vital qualities of the human species remain a blank space on the scientific map. I think it an error to pivot discussions of ethics upon the freestanding assumptions of contemporary philosophers who have evidently never given thought to the evolutionary origin and material functioning of the human brain. In no other domain of the humanities is a union with the natural sciences more urgently needed. When the ethical dimension of human nature is at last fully opened to such exploration, the innate epigenetic rules of moral reasoning will probably not prove to be aggregated into simple instincts such as bonding, cooperativeness, or altruism. Instead, the rules most probably will turn out to be an ensemble of many algorithms whose interlocking activities guide the mind across a landscape of nuanced moods and choices. Such a pre-structured mental world may at first seem too complicated to have been created by autonomous genetic evolution alone. But all the evidence of biology suggests that just this process was enough to spawn the millions of species of life surrounding us. Each kind of animal is furthermore guided through its life cycle by unique and often elaborate sets of instinctual algorithms, many of which are beginning to yield to genetic and neurobiological analyses. With all these examples before us, it is not unreasonable to conclude that human behavior originated the same way. Meanwhile, the mélanges of moral reasoning employed by modern societies are, to put the matter simply, a mess. They are chimeras composed of odd parts stuck together. Paleolithic egalitarian and tribalistic instincts are still firmly installed. As part of the genetic foundation of human nature, they cannot be replaced. In some cases, such as quick hostility to strangers and competing groups, they have become generally ill-adapted and persistently dangerous. Above the fundamental instincts rise superstructures of arguments and rules that accommodate the novel institutions created by cultural evolution. These accommodations, which reflect the attempt to maintain order and further tribal interests, have been too volatile to track by genetic evolution. They are not yet in the genes. Little wonder, then, that ethics is the most publicly contested of all philosophical enterprises. or that political science, which at foundation is primarily the study of applied ethics, is so frequently problematic. Neither is informed by anything that would be recognizable as authentic theory in the natural sciences. Both ethics and political science lack a foundation of verifiable knowledge of human nature sufficient to produce cause and effect predictions and sound judgments based on them. Surely it will be prudent to pay closer attention to the deep springs of ethical behavior. The greatest void in knowledge in such a venture is the biology of the moral sentiments. In time, this subject can be understood, I believe, by paying attention to the following topics. The definition of the moral sentiments. First, by precise descriptions from experimental psychology, then by analysis of the underlying neural and endocrine responses. The genetics of the moral sentiments. Most easily approached through measurements of the heritability of the psychological and physiological processes of ethical behavior, and eventually, with difficulty, by identification of the prescribing genes. The development of the moral sentiments as products of the interactions of genes and environment. The research is most effective when conducted at two levels: the histories of ethical systems as part of the emergence of different cultures, and the cognitive development of individuals living in a variety of cultures. Such investigations are already well along in anthropology and psychology. In the future, they will be augmented by contributions from biology. The deep history of the moral sentiments. Why they exist in the first place? Presumably, by their contributions to survival and reproductive success during the long periods of prehistoric time in which they genetically evolved. From a convergence of these several approaches, the true origin and meaning of ethical behavior may come into focus. If so, a more certain measure can then be taken of the strengths and flexibility of the epigenetic rules composing the various moral sentiments. From that knowledge, it should be possible to adapt the ancient moral sentiments more wisely to the swiftly changing conditions of modern life into which, willy-nilly and largely in ignorance, we have plunged ourselves. Then, new answers might be found for the truly important questions of moral reasoning. How can the moral instincts be ranked? Which are best subdued and to what degree? Which validated by law and symbol? How can precepts be left open to appeal under extraordinary circumstances? In the new understanding can be located the most effective means for reaching consensus. No one can guess the form the agreements will take. The process, however, can be predicted with assurance. It will be democratic, weakening the clash of rival religions and ideologies. History is moving decisively in that direction, and people are by nature too bright and too contentious to abide anything else, and the pace can be confidently predicted. Change will come slowly, across generations, because old beliefs die hard even when demonstrably false. The same reasoning that aligns ethical philosophy with science can also inform the study of religion. Religions are analogous to superorganisms. They have a life cycle. They are born, they grow, they compete, they reproduce, and, in the fullness of time, most die. In each of these phases, religions reflect the human organisms that nourish them. They express a primary rule of human existence, that whatever is necessary to sustain life is also ultimately biological. Successful religions typically begin as cults, which then increase in power and inclusiveness until they achieve tolerance outside the circle of believers. At the core of each religion is a creation myth, which explains how the world began and how the chosen people, those subscribing to the belief system, arrived at its center. There is often a mystery, a set of secret instructions and formulas available only to hierophants who have worked their way to a higher state of enlightenment. The medieval Jewish Kabbalah, the trigradal system of Freemasonry, and the carvings on Australian Aboriginal spirit sticks are examples of such arcana. Power radiates from the center, gathering converts and binding followers to the group. Sacred places are designated where the gods can be importuned, rites observed, and miracles witnessed. The devotees of the religion compete as a tribe with those of other religions. They harshly resist the dismissal of their beliefs by rivals. They venerate self-sacrifice in defense of the religion. The tribalistic roots of religion and those of moral reasoning are similar and may be identical. Religious rites, as evidenced by burial ceremonies, are very old. In the late Paleolithic period of Europe and the Middle East, it appears that bodies were sometimes placed in shallow graves, sprinkled with ochre or blossoms, and it is easy to imagine ceremonies performed there that invoke spirits and gods. But as theoretical deduction and the evidence suggest, the primitive elements of moral behavior are far older than Paleolithic ritual. Religion arose on an ethical foundation, and it has probably always been used in one manner or another to justify moral codes. The formidable influence of the religious drive is based on far more, however, than just the validation of morals. A great subterranean river of the mind, it gathers strength from a broad spread of tributary emotions. Foremost among them is the survival instinct. Fear, as the Roman poet Lucretius said, was the first thing on earth to make gods. Our conscious minds hunger for a permanent existence. If we cannot have everlasting life of the body, then absorption into some immortal whole will serve. Anything will serve, as long as it gives the individual meaning and somehow stretches into eternity that swift passage of the mind and spirit lamented by St. Augustine as the short day of time. The understanding and control of life is another source of religious power. Doctrine draws on the same creative springs as science and the arts, its aim being the extraction of order from the mysteries of the material world. To explain the meaning of life, it spins mythic narratives of the tribal history, populating the cosmos with protective spirits and gods. The existence of the supernatural, if accepted, testifies to the existence of that other world so desperately desired. Religion is also empowered mightily by its principal ally, tribalism. The shamans and priests implore us in somber cadence, "Trust in the sacred rituals. Become part of the immortal force. You are one of us. As your life unfolds, each step has mystic significance that we who love you will mark with a solemn rite of passage, the last to be performed when you enter that second world, free of pain and fear." If the religious mythos did not exist in the culture, it would be quickly invented, and in fact, it has been, everywhere, thousands of times through history. Such inevitability is the mark of instinctual behavior in any species. That is, even when learned, it is guided towards certain states by emotion-driven rules of mental development. To call religion instinctive is not to suppose any particular part of its mythos is untrue, only that its sources run deeper than ordinary habit and are, in fact, hereditary, urged into birth through biases in mental development encoded in the genes. I have argued in previous chapters that such biases are to be expected as a usual consequence of the brain's genetic evolution. The logic applies to religious behavior with the added twist of tribalism. There is a hereditary selective advantage to membership in a powerful group united by devout belief and purpose. Even when individuals subordinate themselves and risk death in common cause, their genes are more likely to be transmitted to the next generation than are those of competing groups who lack equivalent resolve. The mathematical models of population genetics suggest the following rule in the evolutionary origin of such altruism. If the reduction of survival and reproduction of individuals due to genes for altruism is more than offset by the increased probability of survival of the group due to the altruism genes will rise in frequency throughout the entire population of competing groups. Put as concisely as possible, the individual pays, his genes and tribe gain, altruism spreads. Let me now suggest a still deeper significance of the empiricist theory of the origin of ethics and religion. If empiricism is disproved and transcendentalism is compellingly upheld, the discovery would be quite simply the most consequential in human history. That is the burden laid upon biology as it draws close to the humanities. If the objective evidence accumulated by biology upholds empiricism, consilience succeeds in the most problematic domains of human behavior and is likely to apply everywhere. But if the evidence contradicts empiricism in any part, universal consilience fails, and the division between science and the humanities will remain permanent all the way to their foundations. The matter is still far from resolved, but empiricism, as I have argued, is well supported thus far in the case of ethics. The objective evidence for or against it in religion is weaker, but at least still consistent with biology. For example, the emotions that accompany religious ecstasy clearly have a neurobiological source. At least one form of brain disorder is associated with hyper-religiosity, in which cosmic significance is given to almost everything, including trivial everyday events. Overall, it is possible to imagine the biological construction of a mind with religious beliefs, although that alone does not dismiss transcendentalism or prove the beliefs themselves to be untrue. Equally important, much, if not all, religious behavior could have arisen from evolution by natural selection. The theory fits crudely. The behavior includes at least some aspects of belief in gods. Propitiation and sacrifice, which are near universals of religious practice, are acts of submission to a dominant being. They are one kind of a dominance hierarchy, which is a general trait of organized mammalian societies. Like humans, animals use elaborate signals to advertise and maintain their rank in the hierarchy. The details vary among species, but also have consistent similarities across the board, as the following two examples will illustrate. In packs of wolves, the dominant animal walks erect and proud, stiff-legged, deliberately paced, with head, tail, and ears up, and stares freely and casually at others. In the presence of rivals, the dominant animal bristles its pelt while curling its lips to show teeth, and it takes first choice in food and space. A subordinate uses opposite signals. It turns away from the dominant individual while lowering its head, ears, and tail, and it keeps its fur sleeked and teeth covered. It grovels and slinks and yields food and space when challenged. In troops of rhesus monkeys, the alpha male of the troop is remarkably similar in mannerisms to a dominant wolf. He keeps his head and tail up, walks in a deliberate, regal manner, while casually staring at others. He climbs nearby objects to maintain height above his rivals. When challenged, he stares hard at the opponent with mouth open, signaling aggression, not surprise, and sometimes slaps the ground with open palms to signal his readiness to attack. The male or female subordinate affects a furtive walk, holding its head and tail down, turning away from the alpha and other higher-ranked individuals. It keeps its mouth shut, except for a fear grimace, and when challenged, makes a cringing retreat. It yields space and food, and in the case of males, estrus females. My point is the following. Behavioral scientists from another planet would notice immediately the semiotic resemblance between animal submissive behavior on the one hand and human obeisance to religious and civil authority on the other. They would point out that the most elaborate rites of obeisance are directed at the gods, the hyper-dominant, if invisible, members of the human group, and they would conclude correctly that in baseline social behavior, not just in anatomy, Homo sapiens has only recently diverged in evolution from a non-human primate stock. Countless studies of animal species with instinctive behavior unobscured by cultural elaboration have shown that membership in dominance orders pays off in survival and lifetime reproductive success. That is true not just for the dominant individuals, but for the subordinates as well. Membership in either class gives animals better protection against enemies and better access to food, shelter, and mates than does solitary existence. Furthermore, subordination in the group is not necessarily permanent. Dominant individuals weaken and die, and as a result, some of the underlings advance in rank and appropriate more resources. It would be surprising to find that modern humans had managed to erase the old mammalian genetic programs and devise other means of distributing power. All the evidence suggests that they have not. True to their primate heritage, people are easily seduced by confident, charismatic leaders, especially males. That predisposition is strongest in religious organizations. Cults form around such leaders. Their power grows if they can persuasively claim special access to the supremely dominant, typically male figure of God. As cults evolve into religions, the image of the supreme being is reinforced by myth and liturgy. In time, the authority of the founders and their successors is graven in sacred texts. Unruly subordinates, known as blasphemers, are squashed. The symbol-forming human mind, however, never stays satisfied with raw, apish feeling in any emotional realm. It strives to build cultures that are maximally rewarding in every dimension. In religion, there is ritual and prayer to contact the supreme being directly, consolation from co-religionists to soften otherwise unbearable grief, explanations of the unexplainable, and the oceanic sense of communion with the larger whole that otherwise surpasses understanding. Communion is the key, and hope rising from it eternal. Out of the dark night of the soul, there is the prospect of a spiritual journey to the light. For a special few, the journey can be taken in this life. The mind reflects in certain ways in order to reach ever higher levels of enlightenment until finally, when no further progress is possible, it enters a mystical union with the whole. Within the great religions, such enlightenment is expressed by the Hindu Samadhi, Buddhist Zen Satori, Sufi Fana, Taoist Wu Wei, and Pentecostal Christian rebirth. Something like it is also experienced by hallucinating pre-literate shamans. What all these celebrants evidently feel, as I once felt to some degree as a reborn evangelical, is hard to put in words, but Willa Cather came as close as possible in a single sentence. "That is happiness," her fictional narrator says in My Antonia, "to be dissolved into something complete and great." Of course, that is happiness, to find the Godhead, or to enter the wholeness of nature, or otherwise to grasp and hold on to something ineffable, beautiful, and eternal. Millions seek it. They feel otherwise.